Hi, and welcome to Creative Playdate, the show for people pursuing creative careers while also raising children. I'm Michelle Condrich. Today, I am very fortunate to introduce an interview that I did with the incredible Debbie Millman. The short version of her introduction is that she is a designer, and she is also the host of the podcast Design Matters, which is one of the first podcasts in the world, actually, and has been broadcasting independently for over 13 years. If you haven't heard that show, you've got to check it out. And this interview is a little bit different from what I have been doing because Debbie Millman is not actually a parent, but I still felt like she was somebody that we could all learn a lot from, both in her attitude towards her work and her positive outlook, really. So today we're taking a little break from the parenting interviews. Let's jump right in. Today I am speaking to Debbie Millman. She is a writer, designer, educator, artist, and brand consultant, as well as being the host of the podcast Design Matters. Welcome to the show, Debbie.
Thank you, Michelle. It's great to be here.
Since most of my listeners are parents in one way or another, I think it would be appropriate to start with the drawing you did when you were 8 years old. You've spoken about this drawing before, but if you don't mind, I'd love to talk to you about that drawing and what it means to you now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Would you like me to describe it?
Yes, that would be great.
Well, it's a drawing that I did when I was about 8 years old or so. My mother gave me a box of ephemera from her basement when she moved from Queens, New York to Florida. And in that box was a drawing that I had created. It was a drawing that when I looked at it, I sort of admired my young handiwork, but also realized after looking at it for just a few minutes that it inadvertently had predicted my entire life. I drew a city scene, a New York City scene, and while I'm a native New Yorker, I had very little knowledge of what Manhattan looked like. At that time, I was living in Howard Beach, Queens, and so that was my only sense of what New York City looked like, and that's not what Manhattan looks like. And I drew a sort of, I guess, typical scene, storefronts and traffic, and I did something really unusual. I labeled most of the things in the drawing, and I had the bank that was labeled bank, and the dry cleaner that was labeled dry cleaner, and taxi and bus and so forth, but the only anomaly in the illustration was that in addition to labeling a delivery truck potato chips, I also drew the Lay's potato chips logo. And so what I realized was that looking at that drawing 40 plus years later, I was living in Manhattan. I was going to the bank and the dry cleaners and traveling around on buses and taxis and was drawing logos for a living. So it was quite an astonishing realization.
Yeah, that's really amazing. What was your relationship with Manhattan like as a kid? I mean, obviously you didn't go very often. When you were a child, did you wish that you could go more often, or was it just sort of this mysterious nearby place?
It wasn't even a mysterious nearby place. I just wasn't cognizant of it. I know my dad worked in Manhattan. He worked at a pharmacy called City Drug, which was around the corner from Carnegie Hall. But the only time I ever went into Manhattan was to go to my dentist, Dr. Balaban, who had an office right near my dad's store where he was working. So I didn't really have much. We didn't go there for parties or shows or Radio City Music Hall or anything like that. I didn't start doing that until long after my parents were divorced and started to see my dad's on the weekend when I was a teenager, like 12 or 13, 14 years old. And then we'd go to an occasional Radio City Music Hall show or more frequently to see Broadway musicals, which he loved.
Mm. When you were going through the box of the ephemera, Did you find other examples like that, or were there a lot of drawings?
There were a few. It was mostly book reports and report cards and things that showed what I was doing more as a student than an artist.
Do you remember if you were drawing a lot? I mean, obviously you were drawing some,
drew.
But
I was drawing. Yeah. No, I drew all the time when I was a kid. My mother was a seamstress, and what she used to do after making the outfits that she would make, and she got her business primarily from the Penny Saver. She would draw the outfits that she'd created for people. And so she taught me how to draw really, really early on. I drew all the time when I was a kid, all the time.
Do you find that your mother's work as a seamstress has influenced you in your artwork?
Well, I made a lot of my own clothes when I was in junior high school. I really wanted beautiful clothes, and my family wasn't in a position to purchase the sort of latest styles and whatnot. My mother made most of my clothes, but then I started making clothes for myself and would find patterns that I really liked and things that felt a bit more stylish and would make things. But as far as the work that she did at the time influencing what I do or did, I think I'm really sort of the perfect Venn diagram of my father's interests as well as my mother's interests, because my father was a businessman and an entrepreneur, and he ultimately bought his own pharmacy and had that from the time I was about eight or nine, probably right after I did that drawing and until he died, which was 3 years ago. So I think my first exposure to brands and really understanding the consumer brand relationship was first going into his store and being mesmerized by things like the Goody Barrettes or the CoverGirl makeup, and then ultimately working as a cashier in his store all through my adolescence and my college years. I would hitchhike from Albany, New York, where I went to school, to his store, which was in Phoenicia, which is about 40 miles west of Woodstock. And I would work for him every weekend. And I think that's really where I developed my branding chops. And that, in combination with the early art lessons from my mother, I think really helped create the person I am today.
I know you didn't go to school for design specifically. I'm wondering at what point, whether it was in school or after the fact, that you really began to see that as the field that you wanted to be in?
Well, I sort of went into design first and foremost as a way to support myself. I only had one marketable skill when I graduated college, and that was being able to do layout and paste up, old school layout and paste up on a drafting table. I had really good mechanical design skills in that, because I was the editor of the arts and features section of the student newspaper back when I was in SUNY Albany, we were required to put the paper together ourselves. And that was where I learned the skills that I had, that I have in design. That's where they first came out. And so I really had no choice. I could either do that or find a job working in the service industry of some sort. I had no other skills. That's what led to my design career. I didn't specifically intend to have a design career. In fact, I thought really I was going to be a journalist, but didn't get into the journalism graduate school that I applied to, then didn't get into an art program that I wanted to take post college, and then ultimately settled into my one career opportunity, which at least what it felt like at the time, which was design. I really came to it quite by accident, never intended for that to be my full career. If anything, I wanted to work in magazines, either as an editorial assistant and then make my way up through the career path to an editor, or perhaps an art director. But design wasn't something that I had ever dreamed about as a kid. I didn't know that design or branding, for that matter, existed as career options. I was not educated in that way and never anticipated that that was going to be what I ended up doing.
Is there anything about that early part of your career that you would do differently, or advice that you would give to young Debbie if you could?
You know, this is a tough question. I asked Seth Godin a similar question last year, and his response has sort of helped form my response to this question, which was that if I went back and changed anything, I wouldn't be who I am today. And so I would be hesitant to change anything because I'm at a point in my life finally where I am extremely happy and feel really, really good about what I'm doing. So I'd hate for that to be jeopardized by going back and making a different decision. That being said, it would have been nice to know that things ultimately would work out by the time I got into my 40s and 50s. But then again, if I knew that, I might not have worked as hard. So who knows? True. It's really, really hard to say. It's really hard to go backwards and think about what I would have done differently, because it's sort of a would have, could have, should have. And I don't want to do that. What I can tell you is that I never believed very much about what was possible for my life as a 20 and 30 year old. And while I wanted very much, I didn't expect very much and felt very little self-esteem. And that did not help my efforts.
It's interesting to think about how your career developed and how young people's careers are developing now with the internet and social media. I wonder, what sort of effect do you think social media has had on your career, other than, you know, obviously like having a website and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I think doing the podcast back in 2005 really helped me forge my path. That certainly couldn't have happened without the internet. That's where it began. And that's now how people access the show as well. So there's no question that the internet has impacted me profoundly. I think one of the concerns now about how we portray ourselves on social media is concerning, in that most people now are positioning themselves on social media the way people position brands, where it's very manufactured. And that's dangerous because lives are not manufactured and cannot be portrayed in a one-dimensional manner in the way that I think many people, including myself, sometimes fall into. And so the notion of confessing fears or portraying oneself with debilitating stage fright or self-esteem issues or lack of confidence is rarely done now because of the long-term possible effects of portraying oneself that way in that moment, which isn't always forever, is very rarely forever. And also because people don't want to be seen as victims or as people that might have, you know, basic human frailties. Mm-hmm. That's unfortunate.
Do you think there's an antidote to this, to that situation?
Oh, I think there's always an antidote. There'll always be a pendulum that swings back and forth. I mean, if you look back at why we became so enamored with social media, it was because we were desperately trying to connect with each other through the devices when we were first living in what the New York Times dubbed an isolation nation back in the early 2000s. You know, the iPod came out in 2001, 6 weeks after 9/11. And from 2001 until 2004, the culture was being perceived as one creating this sense of isolation via our dependence and infatuation with the iPod, where we were living in our own self-created bubbles. Mm-hmm. Then what happened in 2005, MySpace was created, because humans are happiest when our brains are resonating harmoniously with others. And in an effort to resonate harmoniously with others in the device, which is what we were spending more and more and more time in, we became enamored with MySpace because we could then communicate with each other through the device. We're not actually addicted to the devices. We're addicted to the feelings that we have through the devices. And so that's when social media really caught on. We were addicted to the feeling that we had in the device through that connection with others. That has now grown to a degree that we are in danger of creating an environment in these spaces, now no longer MySpace, but now Facebook or Instagram or any of the other social sites that we play with, where we're creating an identity as opposed to living an identity.
On the show, I speak to both mothers and fathers in creative fields, and they definitely have different perspectives on being a parent. And I think that this is a little bit related to social media and how you're portraying yourself. I found that women often wrestle with whether or not to make it known publicly that they are mothers. They're afraid they're not going to be taken seriously or won't be hired because a client might think that they're too distracted or...
Very well-known designer who, after the birth of her first child, was really had a significant decrease in business because people somehow thought she'd be too busy or that she was preoccupied or distracted. So that when she had her second child, she barely even talked about it on social media because she didn't want her practice to be impacted. And that's tragic. That's absolutely tragic.
Well, related to that, have you ever had aspects of your personal life as a woman that you felt that you needed to hide from employers or clients?
Well, two. For a long time, and it's really only in the last year or two that I talked about the early childhood sexual assault that really impacted me. And it's only in the last couple of years that I've been talking about it. I felt tremendous shame, tremendous self-hatred, and that was something that I hid because I was afraid people would think I was damaged or that I was somehow less than. And that's a big, big, big part of the reason that I started to work with Mariska Hargitay and her foundation to help eradicate sexual assault, domestic violence, and child abuse. So in many ways, that helps me feel now that that my life makes sense and my life's work makes sense. But it really wasn't until I started doing that I actually felt proud of what I could do through my experiences to try to make the world a safer place for children. And so that's one thing. And then, I came out later in life. I didn't come out until I was 50, not because I was living in the closet, but because I was even too afraid to even acknowledge that I could have a different sexual identity. And so, you know, I've been married. I've had many, many relationships with men. Probably now would be... considered bisexual, given how much time I've spent over the decades and in my life with men. I just prefer now to be with women and so consider myself to be gay. But I didn't come out until I was 50. And when I first did, was extremely worried based on my own homophobia that people would see me differently, judge me, think less of me. And that was scary. I was also afraid that clients might not want to work with me for whatever reason. All, again, internalized homophobia. But I grew up in the 70s and it was not something that people were as free to be back then. It required a lot, much more bravery than I had. And given my already early childhood feelings that were cemented very early on of being ashamed of who I was, just being ashamed even more felt too much for me.
And since coming out, has there actually been any, not backlash is not the right word,
not one thing. It was all internalized homophobia.
Yeah. Have you seen Hannah Gadsby's Netflix?
Oh, yes. Several times.
Yeah. We actually watched it a couple of times as well. Like you mentioned, this idea of internalized homophobia has been really interesting to me, especially how I deal with my daughter. And I've said this to my husband before, like this, sometimes I'll change pronouns in the books that she has when it's like the hungry caterpillar, who cares if it's a boy or a girl or whatever. And he always kind of like thinks it's a silly thing to do. I mean, he doesn't say that. He just kind of like laughs a little bit when I do it. But after we watched that, I said to him, I said, this is why I do that, because we don't know what she's going to be one day, what she is. And I don't want to do that. The idea of not raising her specifically as being straight or gay or anything really, really has impacted the way I think about raising my daughter and interacting with her.
That's great. That's wonderful.
Well, I would love to hear a little bit more about your experience just being a woman in a heavily male-dominated industry. The time or the situation now, the circumstances now are obviously a lot different than they were when you started out. You mentioned in an interview working as like a layout and paste-up girl. Were you actually referred to as a paste-up girl?
I don't think I was ever referred to as a paste-up girl.
Okay.
I don't think that the word girl was ever used. Did I actually say that?
I can't find the exact interview off the top of my head. But no.
I take it back.
No. I just wondered if that was, you know, I know there for a long time there still were, you know, positions like that for women who that were referred to as.
Yeah, I mean,
way.
I wasn't put in a marginalized position as a layout and paste-up artist. I actually was treated equally, aside from the sexual harassment. But the actual job that I was doing was similar to that to the job that my male cohorts were doing. At my first job at the cable magazine that I was working at, I was sexually harassed twice. But again, this was in the early 80s. I wasn't really thinking about this as something culturally pervasive. I thought it was something that I was doing wrong to elicit such a response, and was worried about what I was wearing or how I was acting, and never really thought that I wasn't getting ahead because I was a woman. Anytime I was rejected or had some sort of failure or didn't get something that I wanted to get, I never assumed it was because I was a woman. I always assumed it was because I was Debbie Millman and there was something wrong with me, not because of my gender. It would have been nice, actually, if that was something that I did feel, so I wouldn't have felt so alone.
Yeah. How do you think that women can better advocate for themselves within creative industries?
Hire each other, support each other, buy each other's work, celebrate each other, ask each other to speak at conferences and at different festivals. There's a lot that we can do for each other that we sometimes find difficult to do for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And if we can celebrate each other and we do that collectively with great camaraderie, I think that collectively we can make a difference for all women in design.
Yeah. Well, let's switch gears just a little bit. And I want to talk about politics as it relates to the work that you do and to your design matters. I know you've written some political commentary, but do you ever create artwork that is a reaction to current political events?
Occasionally, right after the election in 2016, the presidential election, Fast Company called me the next day and asked me to comment on what designers can do. And I almost wrote back and said nothing because I was crying and so despondent and really, really crushed. And then all of a sudden, almost as if it came through me as opposed to in me, I made a piece that I called Today, Tomorrow. And on the left side, it says today, cry, mourn, second guess, worry, grieve. And then on the other side, it says tomorrow, unify, work harder, plan, mobilize, make a difference. And that's probably one of my favorite political pieces. I did do work for the Hillary Clinton campaign. I designed and illustrated buttons and consulted on her campaign. That was very, very important to me. I'm doing a little bit of work right now with Planned Parenthood. Obviously do work with the No More organization and the Joyful Heart Foundation. So I would say a lot of my work has a political thread running through it. But I wouldn't say that I have plans to do anything politically, although who knows?
You speak to all kinds of artists, and obviously artists are often reacting to the times. Have you ever done interviews where you've disagreed with what your guest is saying on kind of a fundamental level? And how do you handle that?
It's a good question. I have to think. Have I ever disagreed with one of my guests? Well, I disagreed very vehemently, and I think pointedly in my interview with Richard Werman, the original founder of the TED conference. I tried to hold my own in that one. It was difficult. I've sometimes pushed back with my guests in suggesting that their ideas about their accomplishments being luck or something that they can't take credit for. I will often push back on that because I think that there's a lot more to it, and luck might really just be hard work and timing. So there are times where I'll absolutely push back. But I don't know that I've had any political disagreements. I haven't interviewed anybody whose politics I'm in opposition to, as far as I can remember.
Mm-hmm. Have you always pushed back as needed with guests, or is that something that you had to learn to do or learn how to do?
I don't know that I would say my first 100 episodes, the episodes that I did on Voice America from 2005 to 2009, those are a bit of a blur. I don't really have a lot of memory of pushing back. I only keep those podcasts on iTunes to prove to people that it takes a long time to be good at something. It's evidence of my growing up as a podcaster in public. I think it took time to just become confident in my abilities as an interviewer and a person that asks questions. And I think that part of being a good interviewer is being very present to the nuances of what people say and being able to respond in as authentic a way as possible. If that means asking the tough question or challenging someone respectfully, I think that that is part of the job of a good interviewer. But I do think that took time for me to become.
Mm-hmm. When Voice America got in touch with you about the show, I wonder what your thoughts were around interviewing people. Had you ever done anything like that before?
I had never done anything like that before, but I do know that one of my skills that's helped me tremendously as I was building a branding consultancy was being very attuned to what people were thinking, what they wanted. And also, I think my success in branding has come from an intrinsic understanding about human behavior and why people buy things and want things and express themselves through things. And I think that that talent and ability helped me become a better interviewer. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it was a skill I was naturally born with. And I don't think any of the work that I've done to become better would have happened without that hard work. But I do think that I have a particular, somewhat endless fascination with people and why they do the things they do and behave the way they behave and make the decisions that they do. How they become who they are is incredibly fascinating to me.
When I was first starting this podcast, I remember hearing you in an interview talking about the early days of Design Matters and the various reasons why you find the early episodes unlistenable. one valuable thing I feel like that I learned from you about podcasting is that my voice doesn't need to be inserted in the conversation as often as it might naturally, or, you know, that a lot of the yeahs and mm-hmms and stuff don't need to be in the final product.
Absolutely.
And I feel I like that from Hillman I appreciate Curtis. That advice.
Yep. Hillman Curtis taught me that. We were doing a live interview with Lawrence Weiner, the great, great conceptual artist. And Hillman pulled me aside and said, "Debbie, you don't need to say mm-hmm after everything he says." And I don't know that I've ever done it since.
Sometimes just one little piece of advice, you know, when you get called out for something, sometimes it sticks real, really fast.
Yep.
So I have been listening to Design Matters for a while, but it wasn't until I started doing some research before we were going to speak that I discovered that you had done over 400 interviews at this point. And that's just incredible. Do you have any favorite interviews that stick out in your mind for one reason or another?
Well, I loved my interview with Chris Ware. I think it's one of my best. I loved my interview with Steven Pinker, Marina Abramovic, Laurie Anderson. It's really hard to say. It's almost like Sophie's Choice. I tend to like my newer episodes more than my older episodes. But then as time goes by, I remember some of those older episodes in different ways. I don't re-listen to the episodes ever, so that's probably why I am more fond of the more recent episodes, just because they're near in my memory. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's always a part of some interview that I really love, because generally I don't stop interviewing somebody until I feel that feeling like, oh, we're connecting. There's that moment where you know that you know what I know, that what they know, we're all thinking the sort of same thing at the same time. And that's a really precious experience.
You know, you've talked about how something that's worthwhile takes a long time, and the podcast being a good example of that. And I wonder if you ever felt like you wanted to quit the podcast.
No, I've never felt that way. I felt that way about other things, but never the podcast. Never. I hope I do this for the rest of my life. I hope I can do it for the rest of my life.
Or have you been basically the director of the entire, I mean, it's just you.
Well, I have a producer, and my producer he and I have been working together since 2009. So it's almost 10 years. And so he produces every episode, and he edits them. And he edits them, I think, based on what he thinks is interesting.
But you all have always been in control of who the guests were.
Yeah. I mean, I do all my own inviting. I don't have a booker. I don't have anybody doing the inviting for me. Sometimes I do get a lot more publicists writing to me about their clients and being on the show. And that's amazing, because sometimes they're people that I never would have believed that I could have had the opportunity to interview. So that's really exciting for me. But for the most part, I just try to reach out to people I admire and think are doing amazing things.
Do you have a pretty long running list?
Yes.
All the time?
Yes. Always. Always. Especially now, you know, the show was originally a show about designers talking about design. And over the last, I would say, 3 to 4 years, the show has evolved from a show that was sort of inside baseball to a show about how incredibly creative people design the arc of their lives. And so that means that I can talk to anybody that's making something amazing. And I love that.
Yeah, that's really, really exciting. Is there anything with the podcast that you are hoping to do in the future? Or do you want to just, continue doing this sort of arc of creativity, as you mentioned? Or is there another direction that you're hoping it will go in one day?
Well, earlier this year, I hired Zachary Pettit, and he was the former editor-in-chief of Print Magazine, and we worked together when I was editor there. And I was editorial and creative director. And now Zach and I are working together with Stephen Heller and Emily Weiland, who works with me at the School of Visual Arts. And we're launching a site that will help to amplify some of the material that I'm doing with Design Matters, and then a whole bunch of other things as well. And that'll be launching in January.
Even though you're not a parent, one reason I really wanted to have you on the show is your attitude towards hard work and persistence. Parents, of course, are working very hard in a lot of different ways. And I think sometimes they feel that by having children, they've really slowed down their career progress. What would you say to people who feel that a major decision that they have made might cost them a measure of the success that they were after?
Well, I have nieces and nephews, so I feel very, very blessed to have the most extraordinary children in my life. I spend a lot of time with my nieces and nephews. The older ones, 7 and 11, I see every month. We have a standing monthly date. And I have a new little niece who's 1 year old, and I just went camping with her and my brother and the family for 5 days, which was lovely. And there's nothing like waking up to a little baby cooing and talking to herself and giggling. And it was just magic. So I feel really lucky that I have siblings that have children that I can help influence and inspire. And I do feel that one of the common denominators that I share with my brothers is a very intense work ethic. You know, it's not just me. We're all like that. It's definitely a Milman trait. And I don't know why exactly we all have that, but we all work really, really hard. My brother I have one brother who's a doctor of pharmacy and has his own practice as well as works in a hospital. My other brother is a special ed teacher in an elementary school upstate New York, but also co-founded a preschool with his wife. I mean, we all do a lot of different things. It's really cool.
It's amazing. Is everybody all in the New York area still?
Pretty much, tri-state area, yes.
Okay, yeah. I'm very envious of people who have that much family close by. It makes a big difference in a lot of ways, you know, if you have a family that you're close to.
Well, it took a lot of time and effort. We've all put in the effort. Our various parents, because we have different parents, some of us have different pieces of family that overlap, but others that don't. There's been a lot of really, really intense struggle in my family. A lot of violence, a lot of abuse, a lot of emotional intensity. So the fact that I've come out the other end with siblings that really do care for each other and are in each other's lives is really one of the big accomplishments that I would say in my life. You know, I'm very proud of that. It's taken a long time.
Yeah. Well, I know that you like to ask people if they knew what they wanted to be when they grew up. And so I want to ask you now at this point, what you would like to be when you grow up.
Me, just happy to be me. I'd like to still feel content with where I'm at and feel that I'm making a difference with my work, doing things that matter, teaching, writing, drawing, making things. You know, I'm happiest when I'm mm-hmm. making things. It could be a lesson plan. It could be a podcast. It could be a meal. It could be the bed, you know. I'm just happy making things.
Well, it sounds like you beat the 80-year-old mark. You mentioned it. I think it was a 99U talk about the
No.
No,
I did not. The 80-year-old mark. When I'm talking about Massimo and Milton, I was talking about people that felt totally okay as is. And didn't need to apologize for anything, didn't need to make excuses for who they were and what they wanted. I struggle with insecurity and lack of self-confidence every day. And so that doesn't mean that I don't want to be who I am and don't want to try to make the most of my life. But I have tremendous fear about not being enough, not being good enough, not being smart enough, not making enough of a difference with my life, especially now as I get older. Wanting my life to have meant something and worried desperately that it doesn't. So no, I'm not there yet, but I yeah. hope to be one day.
When you were speaking to them about that, did you feel like they truly felt that way?
Yes.
Or that, okay.
Without a doubt. It wasn't even something that they stated. It was just apparent in who they are.
Okay.
You know, Milton's still very much alive. So yeah. Very, very, very present.
How do you deal with those feelings of being not good enough? Like, do you have an answer for times when you're feeling that especially strongly?
Therapy helps. Doing it anyway helps. Working to make something better for somebody else in that moment helps. I have a whole slew of coping mechanisms.
I think the doing it. Did you say ice cream?
Yeah.
Any particular flavor work better than another?
I like any kind of chocolate ice cream with things in it, like almonds or chocolate chips or sprinkles, or I like crunchy ice cream.
Yes, I feel very strongly. I agree about the chocolate with stuff in it is always the way to go. Well, Debbie, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. It's been really an honor to talk to you. And I know that my listeners will enjoy hearing from you.
Thank you, Michelle. I really enjoy talking with you too.
Thanks again, Debbie, for talking to me and agreeing to be on Creative Playdate. Debbie is a really inspiring figure. And again, if you haven't heard her podcast, Design Matters, please go check it out. She's also got a lot of great interviews and talks that she's done on her website, which is debbiemilman.com. Trust me, once you start listening to Debbie, you will be hooked. Creative Playdate is syndicated at illustrationage.com. Our theme music was created by Thomas James and Jason Ritz. And you can follow the show on social media, on Twitter at Playdate Podcast and on Instagram at creative_playdate_podcast. And you can learn more about myself and my work at michellekondrich.com. Please be sure to rate and review the podcast if you love it. Thank you so much for listening. Now go play.